It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll meet the Arizona Democratic Party's new chair, who was elected over the weekend. We'll also find out what happened at the state Republican Party's meeting, which included some love and some rebukes for Senator John McCain. Also, do human trafficking and sex trafficking become more prevalent around international sporting events like the Super Bowl? We'll talk about it. Plus, if I told you the National Football League was a nonprofit, you probably wouldn't believe me. ASU professor Mary Feeney will explain how an organization with a leader who made $44 million in salary last year is really, truly a nonprofit. We start today's program with the issues of border security and immigration reform. On Tuesday afternoon, U.S. House leaders indefinitely postponed a vote on a border security bill labeled Secure Our Borders. The bill would penalize the Department of Homeland Security if it fails to secure operational control, in other words, to stop all illegal border crossings within 5 years. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake is a co-sponsor of a similar, though far from identical, bill in the Senate. We spoke earlier and started our conversation by talking about what operational control at the southern border really means.
Well, there's an acceptable level of apprehensions and turnbacks and recidivism. It's a metric that we should have that the Department of Homeland Security has never developed. And in the Senate bill, we put it at 95% apprehension rate. This bill would want to take it a little further than that. But to me, it's having some effective measure of how well you're doing at the border.
And do you think that's reachable?
Yeah, I do. I mean, 100% apprehension, that's a tough standard to get. But the 95% apprehension rate, we felt that was certainly doable.
Are supporters of a general operational control provision believing that putting billions more dollars into border security is going to be effective? And I say it only because there's cynicism out there that the argument of throwing money at a problem without a solid approach doesn't make sense. Do you think the approach really is solid?
I think that it has to be done in coordination, or at least in sequence with some other things. If we have an effective framework for workers to come and return home, then we'll relieve a lot of pressure on the border, and effective operational control will be easier to obtain. The problem is, when we've tried to do a comprehensive bill like this, we couldn't get it through the House, and now the president, having gone piecemeal, has really made it impossible for the House to move a comprehensive bill.
What do you think of the efforts then to overturn President Obama's executive actions, regardless of whether you think it was the wrong approach or piecemeal? Should work be done right now to overturn it?
My feeling has always been, rather than stick a finger in the president's eye, let's put legislation on his desk. And so it's really difficult to try to parse out what you can do with regard to the president's action and what you can't do through appropriation bills. So I'd rather take a different approach, just move legislation, border bill, interior enforcement bill, guest worker plan, and then a mechanism to deal with those who are here illegally. That's my preferred option, and that's what I'd hoped we could do with this border bill, but it's running into problems in the House.
It seems like border security can get a little bit muddled, and I'm saying this as a layperson. The idea that border security is, are we worried about folks related to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, or are we worried about people who are crossing the border looking for work? Where do you stand on where, when we talk about border security, which is it the priority to take care of all those folks, or should we have a priority based on one or the other?
I don't think we have the luxury of a choice these days. You've got to have a more secure border. You know, when I was growing up in northern Arizona, we had a fairly open border, but there was interior enforcement, at the farm level or whatever, and they would take some people back, and we didn't worry as much at that point about obviously Al-Qaeda or people coming for purposes of terrorism. But you can't totally dismiss that now, although certainly the vast majority of those who come are coming simply to work.
Why do you think, I guess it's the world of Washington, but why is the issue, and I say certainly more so in, as far as border security, the focus is concerned, why does this seem to be such a, you're an exception to this, but why does it seem to be such a partisan issue where it's almost predictable which side a party is going to rest on this issue?
I don't know. I don't think it should be. Arizona pays the price, for the federal government's failure to deal with this issue both on the border security side and to have a rational policy in terms of how many we allow to come and work. And so but I don't see why it falls along party lines so neatly. It doesn't completely, but you're right, for the most part it does, and it shouldn't.
The advancements, potential advancements, at least the Obama administration has made in regard to Cuba, I wonder if you could talk in a general sense about what you think that means for U.S. relations in general with Latin America, though Cuba in many ways has been an exception in and of itself, especially with Hugo Chavez out. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Can this be a broader relationship builder? Does the U.S. need that kind of thing?
Well, it will help. Yeah, there are a number of countries who have simply refused to attend meetings or refused to deal with the U.S. until we had a change of policy on Cuba. That's not reason enough in itself, because we will often take positions that are contrary to what some of our neighbors in Latin America think. But on this point, I think it was a needless irritant that we, having moved beyond much of it, hopefully, we'll have better relations with some of our neighbors.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with U.S. Senator Jeff Flake for a couple of more minutes. Senator Flake, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson traveled to Arizona. He was at the southern border on Tuesday talking with ranchers. In general, regardless of whether the executive action plays into this or not, what do you think of the administration's approach, or at least thoughts, things you've talked about behind the scenes as far as border security is concerned?
Well, I've met with Jay Johnson a number of times, and he's frankly been easier to deal with than previous administrators there or secretaries. But in particular, we have a sticking point now with regard to the Yuma sector in particular, the Operation Streamline, or kind of expedited removal and a consequences program for those who come across. We've had an effective program, and Department of Justice seems to be doing away with it. And so we have real questions as to why, when we have something that's worked pretty well and has led to better control of a portion of the border, we ought to expand that, not get rid of it.
What do you think your constituents' expectations, and even those in other states and other districts, should expect when it comes to the issue of immigration reform? Is this something that, should we even bother talking about the phrase comprehensive immigration reform anymore? Is that a dead concept?
Well, I think it's the president has made it pretty impossible to move a comprehensive bill, one piece of legislation, but right now. But I think it's still possible to move a series of bills, to do it in sequence, that we'll have the same result in the end. Let's face it, if we were to completely close down the border, land crossings at the border, nearly 40% of those who are here illegally, came legally, came here on some kind of student visa or vacation visa or whatever, and have simply overstayed. And so it's going to involve far more elements than just more agents or more technology on the border. But we'll have to move it in separate bills because that's what the political climate calls for right now.
Well, just to follow up on that, when you say about President Obama taking the action on his own, is that the equivalent of you saying that you don't think that other members of Congress should poke the president in the eye, they instead should put legislation on his desk? Is this a tit-for-tat situation where we don't like because the president did that, rather than look at the merits of what he did, or the merits being taken into account as well?
I think there's some of both. I think that that justifiably a lot of members of the Congress feel that some of the measures the president took are not measures that any president can take on his own. These are the province of the Congress. Having said that, it's just there's a lot of distrust right now of the president's actions and what he will do with legislation that we send him. For my position, I've been in favor of comprehensive reform. I wish it were still possible now. I just don't think it is, and so we'll have to move piecemeal.
Senator Flake, thanks as always. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Bye.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. We just heard from Arizona's junior Senator Jeff Flake. Meanwhile, online today at thehill.com, reporters Scott Wong and Cameron Joseph write that senior Senator John McCain may again face a primary challenge if he runs for re-election in the 2016 cycle. And that challenge could come from an incumbent member of Congress. Scott Wong of The Hill, also a former Arizona Republic reporter, joins us now for a few minutes. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. So who are the big-name representatives who may be looking seriously at taking on Senator McCain?
Well, we have a couple of familiar faces. It's Congressman David Schweikert and Congressman Matt Salmon. They've been in Arizona politics for a long time, both conservatives, and both are taking a hard look at this Senate challenge to John McCain. Of course, McCain is tough to beat. He's been in Congress, I think, since the 1980s. He has a pretty big war chest. He has big name ID, obviously ran for president twice and won the nomination in 2008. But a lot of conservatives think that McCain is ripe for a challenge, and I think conservatives certainly will be lining up.
In your story, it sounds like Salmon and Schweikert would defer to each other and not run against each other. Did that sound believable to you?
I think Schweikert was genuine when he said, you know, I mean, these guys are best buddies on Capitol Hill. They talk to one another probably on a daily basis. They're always aligned together on votes, part of the very conservative wing of the Republican Party. And what Schweikert told me in an interview on the Hill was, basically if Matt Salmon pulls the trigger, then Schweikert would defer to him. In fact, he even said that he would be willing and raise his hand to run Matt Salmon's campaign committee.
Based on what you know about the two of them, and as you mentioned, Salmon especially has been involved in Arizona politics for a long time, would their friendship or their deferral to each other change at all if Senator McCain were to announce he was not running and that seat were open?
That's an interesting scenario. I think at that time, if McCain announced that he's going to ride off into the sunset, I think all bets are off. I think everyone will be looking at that race. You have a number of lawmakers who I think are interested, not only Matt Salmon and Schweikert, but also on the other side of the aisle, Kyrsten Sinema, a Democrat, is somebody who's often named as somebody who's interested in that Senate seat when John McCain retires. But at this point, McCain's people are saying he is doing everything necessary to prepare himself for another election. He's raising money. He's traveling, all parts of the state. He is, getting in touch with constituents. And so at this point, there's nothing to suggest that he's ready to call it quits.
Scott, I'm glad you brought up money because obviously Senator McCain has a huge war chest and these Senate races are getting more and more expensive all the time. If you could generalize, how much money would be needed to put up a really strong challenge in a primary?
Ooh, I think we're talking certainly in the millions of dollars, if not, approaching $10 million. These races are getting more and more expensive. And of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that a single candidate would have to raise all of that money. So many outside groups, the Senate Conservatives Fund, various groups here in Washington, Tea Party groups, are playing in these Senate elections. And so it would be a collection of what the candidates raise as well as what some of these outside groups who are not supposed to coordinate with the candidates themselves would raise.
Scott, in your piece for The Hill, there was one Republican strategist who kind of made fun of the last person to challenge Senator McCain in the primary, Congressman J.D. Hayworth. How much better a candidate would either Salmon or Schweikert be in comparison to Hayworth?
I think they would be much savvier. I mean, everyone has learned lessons from 2010 when McCain, when it was thought that McCain had a tough primary challenge from the right, from J.D. Hayworth, a congressman himself with some name ID. McCain destroyed him in the election in part by defining him very early and launching attack ad after attack ad. But I think McCain certainly has the benefit of going through that campaign. He will be on the lookout. He's certainly aware of these two congressmen who are taking a look at this race. But I think also Schweikert and Salmon, you know, have the benefit of knowing what J.D. Hayworth went through in 2010 and will be, you know, more prepared as candidates if they choose to jump into that race.
Scott Wong, former Arizona Republic reporter who now works for The Hill in the nation's capital. Interesting piece at thehill.com about Senator John McCain's possible primary challengers. You can follow Scott on Twitter at Scott Wong DC. Scott, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet the new chair of the Arizona State Democratic Party. Also a little bit later on this hour, we'll talk about human trafficking around the Super Bowl. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Music Fest, featuring the Duke Ellington Orchestra on February 6th. The big band performs Ellington standards as part of the month-long festival of jazz, classical, and more. azmusicfest.org.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, Flagstaff is sunny and 44 degrees. It's mostly sunny and 50 in Prescott right now. 62 degrees under sunny skies in Tucson. It's sunny and 59 in Casa Grande and partly sunny and 68 degrees in Yuma. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on the eastbound Red Mountain Loop 202 freeway, a bad situation. A crash has both exit ramps to the Loop 101 closed right now. No word on when those will reopen. And on the Loop 101 in the North Valley, there's a crash on the eastbound frontage road at the I-17. We proudly recognize members of our Leadership Society, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks Hilliard, for their support of news and information on KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Partly sunny skies right now in the valley and 67 degrees at 1124.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The results of November's election did not turn out well for Arizona Democrats. Even with a slate of statewide candidates that were considered experienced and capable, the Democrats were defeated in the races for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, among others. Last weekend, the party elected a new chair, and for the first time, a woman will be leading the state party. She is Alexis Tamarone, who was chief of staff for Congressman Harry Mitchell and the party's first vice chair for the past 2 years. And she joins me now in studio. Alexis, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So why would you want this job?
I've been questioned a lot, and I told my friends that it was okay to question my sanity for a while. But I think just given my experience working in Arizona, being an Arizona native, I have, a lot of time invested, not only in the party, but in making change, where I believe positive change of this state. After the congressman lost his reelection in 2010, I chose to come back to Arizona because I wanted to come home and make sure that we would inherit a state that I could not only be proud of, I am proud of it right now, but to invest in those things that I believe we need to invest in, whether it be our education and mainly having access and opportunity for Arizona families who continue to struggle.
I certainly want to get into those core issues in our conversation, but the one issue that I think when people think about a party chair, there's a lot of fundraising that goes into it. So from that standpoint, how much time will you have to spend on getting people revved up about the party again and wanting them to give money to the party?
I think a majority of my time will be spent on that. I think what I had said, not only on Saturday, but leading up to that election for the state party chair, was that we had to do things a little bit differently. We're still going to have to raise money. We're still going to have to grow our membership and basically have a coherent message of why people should be voting for Democrats in the state of Arizona, or at least giving us an opportunity to make our case. And so I think majority of my time will be spent on the what I call the fundamentals and the infrastructure of the party. And we can't do a lot of what I hope to do, whether it be to articulate a message and or grow our numbers, unless we have the money to do it.
How concerned are you about dark money and how that affected the races?
I'm very concerned about it. I believe that, a lot of people have said that it was almost like our elections are now up for auction to the highest bidder. And I think that the only way you can combat, besides legislation and trying to fix some disclosure laws, is to make sure you have more people than money. And that goes back to the infrastructure and building of the party, because the only way you can combat the effects of dark money is to make sure you have a lot more people engaged and want to, that honest and open government that they were hoping to see. So it goes back to making sure essentially you have more people than the dollars flowing in.
So if the laws don't change and what many label dark money is continued to be available, can the Democratic Party stay strong without giving into some of that? Can you defeat it with numbers as opposed to cash?
I do believe that you can. It's just going to take different tactics. A lot of it's going to be outreach and social media driven. We can see that even when a piece of legislation is dropped at the Arizona legislature, it's instantly out there for people to comment. And we see now lawmakers and other individuals who are in elected positions are aware, and they respond quickly. Even we saw that with the piece of legislation to change our time zones. People weren't happy with that, and that it had a very short life. So I think that using different tactics, and because the Democratic Party has to use different tactics, we are still the third party in this state, that we have to use everything at our disposal and be a little creative. And I think that given my perspective and kind of experience on campaigns before, where we were usually outfunded, we were able to make up ground in creativity.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Alexis Tamarone, who is leading the Arizona Democratic Party as of last weekend. Alexis, how much did turnout, or lack thereof, hurt the Democrats in November?
Oh, it was obviously devastating to our candidates. There was 39 states that had decreased turnout worse than 2010, which we believed, a lot of folks believed across the country, was the worst year for Democrats. And in particular, especially off a drop-off election, or what we call a midterm from a presidential, we can tell in just the numbers that I believe it was around 11% turnout just from 18 to 34-year-olds. And in Arizona in particular, it was 71% turnout for people who are 50 or over. And we know that that electorate tends to be a little bit more conservative. And the folks that we needed to turn out, who we were targeting to turn out, did not come out. And mainly it was a motivation, a lack of enthusiasm for, I believe, in terms of why the turnout was as bad as it was.
How much does the party have to appeal to young Latinos, young Latinas, to get them excited and get them feeling strong about the party? There are some who will say that presidential election year coming up in 2016, that should be a positive for the Democratic Party. Also, the fact that if Sheriff Joe Arpaio decides to run again, that could be a positive for the Democratic Party. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I draw upon from 2012. I had the opportunity to run Dr. Richard Carmona's U.S. Senate race, and we came pretty close, a little under 3%. And if you look across the results, the only age group in which Dr. Carmona overperformed and won overwhelmingly was the 18 to 34-year-olds. So we know that demographic tends to vote more Democratic. So it's going to be a challenge for us to make sure that we have a coherent message to articulate and motivate those young individuals to come out and vote because of the various different issues that are affecting them, whether it be, you know, the cost of college and having debt right out of graduation, but also the opportunity to make sure you can graduate and have a job and be what they want to be as productive members of society.
And how much work would you have to do as chair to work with candidates? There are many people who would say that even though Dr. Carmona had not run for office before, he was a candidate that a lot of people on the right and the left were kind of excited about. So how do you get it so, because not every candidate's going to have his resume, how do you get them knowing how to run a race and run it well?
I think you start off with folks who are in civic organizations who are working in their community right now, whether you're a school board member or thinking about running for school board or you sit on a city council. You're already ingrained in your community and know what the issues are. You have the background already with the individuals. And usually in these nonpartisan races, that's where you also can get ahead without not having put a DNR behind your name. So I think it's going to be important to look at, to see what that pipeline looks like, and to make sure we're putting more people in that pipeline to do that, because there's a lot of people who serve their community and want to continue to serve their community or find a way to, and that's where you start. And I think that's where our best crop of individuals are going to come from to run for offices in the future here in Arizona.
Alexis, finally, Democrats have done well at times, certainly in congressional races, sometimes in statewide races, less so when it comes to legislative races. Are the districts drawn in such a way that this is going to be really hard for Democrats to make up seats, or do you think there is a strategic aspect behind that as well that can help Democrats get more seats?
Well, I think it's a really good idea, and we see a lot more states replicating an independent redistricting committee to make sure that you take the job of drawing maps out of hands of the people who are going to sit in those districts, to have the opportunity to make sure the districts are drawn in a competitive way, because I believe that when you have competitive elections, and it could be in a legislative district anywhere, you get better candidates for it. So I think that given the current maps, it's and the current demographics of the state, these are good maps. They reflect Arizona. And so I think moving forward, you just have to make sure you have great candidates who can run in those districts, and just have candidates in general in those districts, even if it's not, a great outlook for a Democrat in particular. But to make the race more competitive and to keep an accountability factor there, I think it's really important that we have competitive elections, we have people who are running in them, we identify people who can and will, and make sure from a party perspective, we are there as a base of support.
Alexis Tamarone is the new chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Thanks for being here, Alexis.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The state GOP also had an important meeting over the weekend. Robert Graham won re-election as the chair, and Senator John McCain faced both supporters and detractors. With me to give us more details is Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
So did Robert Graham face legitimate opposition, or was this more of a protest kind of vote?
It seemed like more of a protest kind of vote. I know in the days leading up to the meeting, there was at least a little bit of chatter that, hey, maybe this is more serious than people are giving it credit for, but that certainly didn't turn out to be the case. Graham defeated Lori Urban, a party activist, by about a 3-1 margin, maybe a little more in the voting, so it was a complete landslide. He cruised to a re-election there.
And what did Graham opponents feel he was lacking?
There are a couple things. Lori Urban and her slate of candidates for the other party offices felt like, you know, he'd ignored the party faithful on a couple issues. One of them was attempting to close the Republican primaries. You know, in Arizona, in the major party primaries, independents can vote in those, and a lot of Republican activists want to close those. And she felt that Lori Urban felt like Robert Graham had kind of been deaf to those pleas. They actually passed a resolution on this later on in the meeting. And she also felt like for all the successes that the Republicans had in Arizona in the election last year, that there were things that could have done better. You know, the Republicans did not expand their majorities in either chamber of the legislature. There are, I'd say, about probably three legislative seats that were contested that the Democrats won in tough races. She felt like that could have been better.
Jeremy, at the party meeting, there were some activists who decided to show John McCain their backside, kind of. Maybe not quite that dramatic, but is the venom toward John McCain still as strong as it had been?
Maybe not as strong as it had been. I mean, I was at that same meeting a year ago when they passed a resolution to censure John McCain for not being conservative enough. And, you know, there was certainly plenty of that sentiment on Saturday. Of course, some people turned their back. Some people booed. There were a couple of hecklers who yelled out to him. But there was also a lot of applause, a lot of support. And obviously, McCain is potentially gearing up for a re-election next year, and there's a lot of chatter about whether or not he could face a primary. And so, of course, for him, it's always going to help to try and shore up that support among the base.
What about some of those names, that those people who really watch Republican politics in the state? A.J. LaFaro, Rob Haney, Tom Morrissey. How did they go over? Did they still have a lot of power within the party?
Yeah, it waxes and wanes. Alfaro actually was a candidate for first vice chair of the party, the number two elected position in the Republican Party, and he actually lost on Saturday to the incumbent, who was part of Robert Graham's slate. Alfaro was part of Lori Urban's slate, and pretty much all except for one person, her entire slate lost, and Graham's side prevailed, including over Alfaro. Now, that was a substantially closer race for first vice chair than it was for chairman, but Alfaro still lost.
Jeremy, to the state capitol now. Governor Doug Ducey selected a new head of the Department of Public Safety. What can you tell us about who he chose, and did he have anything to say about the ongoing head of, or the outgoing head of DPS, Robert Halliday? Were there any comments about him?
I don't believe so. Not so much. Now, the person he chose for the new director was Frank Milstead. He's been the Mesa police chief since, I believe, 2010, and he's been he was with the Phoenix Police Department for about 25 years before that. I've heard, definitely heard some good things about Frank Milstead. I was just speaking earlier today with Scott Smith, the former mayor of Mesa, who was there when Milstead became chief. And he said, what he told me is that you know, he's someone who knows how to run an agency effectively in times of kind of fiscal crisis, budget cuts, fiscal constraints, which is obviously something that the state is facing now. And very liked by the rank-and-file officers. You know, he was an officer for a long time himself, motorcycle officer, that he gets along with folks of all ranks. And yeah, I'm hearing some enthusiasm about this pick.
Interesting. Okay. About a minute. Yeah, about a minute left, Jeremy. I want to squeeze this in. Are Governor Ducey and GOP legislative leaders still on the same page, still enjoying each other's company, maybe a glass of wine a couple of weeks into the legislative session?
From what we've seen so far, I haven't seen really much in the way of disagreement so far. You know, when he, as Governor Ducey was preparing to unveil his first executive budget proposal, he held a press conference earlier in the day with Senate President Andy Biggs and House Speaker David Gowan, which is kind of a show of solidarity and unity, which is something, you know, I don't, in the you know, 6 or so years I've been at the Capitol, I've certainly never seen that, even though we had a Republican governor to go with the Republican legislature. So that's, I think, at least so far, a level of agreement that we haven't really seen much. Now, of course, it's still very early in the session. There's plenty of time for everyone to fight over this and that. But the Republican lawmakers I've spoken to, both leadership and rank and file, feel like Ducey's very willing to listen to their concerns if if they have some concerns. Everyone's kind of on the same page in terms of what they want to accomplish. And what I'm told is that lawmakers have a different idea than the governor and kind of how they'd like to accomplish that. He's he's all ears, and they feel like he's been very receptive so far. But once again, it's early in the session, so we'll see.
Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks as always.
No problem, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out about human trafficking around the Super Bowl. Plus, how is it possible the National Football League is a nonprofit? We'll find out coming up on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by FX, presenting The Americans, starring Keri Russell and Matthew Rhys, tonight at 10, only on FX. More at fxnetworks.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on the Red Mountain Loop 202, the eastbound exit ramps to the Loop 101 are closed by a crash. And on the Loop 101 eastbound at Scottsdale Road, there's a crash blocking the right lanes. Valley forecast calling for partly cloudy to partly sunny skies today, a high near 77 degrees. It'll be cloudy again tomorrow, the high expected again to be 77, and we've got a 70% chance for rain in the evening. Stay with us at noon for Here and Now from Boston. Today, the Mexican government has officially declared 43 missing college students dead, but parents of the students are claiming a cover-up. Partly sunny skies and 67 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:41.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Over the past two Sundays, the Arizona Republic's Richard Ruelas wrote about human trafficking in the Valley. We talked with Ruelas last week on the show.
There are activists who now say that you could be trafficked by your drug addiction. You could be trafficked by your life circumstances. You need money to feed your kid. The street prostitute is now seen as a trafficking victim, even though it's not what would be conjured up in most people's minds when they hear the word trafficked.
Trafficking has been receiving more attention in recent years, especially around international sporting events like the Super Bowl. But it's an ever-present problem. To learn more, I talked with Bradley Miles, CEO of the national organization, the Polaris Project. I started by asking him for a definition of human trafficking.
The main legislation to understand is the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. It's the year 2000 where that act was passed in Congress. And really what that act did is it set out a federal definition for the whole country to use of what human trafficking is. Breaks down into three pretty simple buckets. The first is child sex trafficking. It's kids under the age of 18 who are exploited in the commercial sex trade. The second bucket is adult sex trafficking. It's adults age 18 or over who are involved in the sex trade, but they're there through some sort of violence or threats or lies. And then the third bucket is any form of labor trafficking. It includes adults and children, and that's anytime someone's working in some sort of labor or service sector, and they're there through violence or threats or lies.
Now, Brad, when it comes to sex trafficking specifically, there has been discussion over the years that major world sporting events, obviously the Super Bowl would fall into that category, are real extra havens for this sort of activity. Is that really the case when people look at the numbers?
It is true that there has been an increased focus on these large sporting events, not just the Super Bowl, but also the Olympics, the World Cup, sometimes even the NCAA March Madness or the NBA All-Star Weekend. I think as somebody who works on this issue day in and day out, the more important point to understand really is that human trafficking is a 365-day-a-year issue. And it's sometimes it can spike a little bit here and there, certain times in response to certain conditions, but really it's the underlying prevalence. This is a huge issue anyway. It's going to be a huge issue weeks before the Super Bowl, and it's going to be a huge issue weeks after the Super Bowl. And so for us, it's helpful to raise awareness during the times of large sporting events, and it can be helpful to raise the public's attention, and there may be a small, modest increase of trafficking that happens in association with these events, but that's not the largest story. The largest story is there's this giant issue facing our country. It's there 365 days a year, and we need to do something more about it.
How is it that it is such an activity that I'm sure has been going on for decades, centuries, that we're not that aware of? The general public hasn't been that aware of it.
I think it's really important to understand that you're absolutely right, that it has been there all along. This isn't a completely new phenomenon that just started happening a few years ago. There's been kids being abused and exploited in the sex trade for decades. There's been adults being tricked and violently deceived and abused in the sex trade for of course, decades. I think what's happening is there's an increasing awareness that it's happening. There was a vacuum of information before, and now I think people have a lens to finally look for it in a certain way. There's increased political will. It's in the news more. There's books and movies that have come out about the issue. It's being taught in classrooms more. So I think we're seeing just a transformation of society to attune their radar to look for something that's been there the whole time. Sometimes they say this is a crime that's hidden in plain sight, is a term that sometimes people use. But this isn't entirely a new crime that just started happening. This is a decades-old crime that we're doing a better job of recognizing now.
Is the concept and the idea that if more people associate this activity with children, if they become more aware that children are put into these situations, then is that part of raising awareness? Is that part of what has made it? It's not just, oh, well, that woman may have been a prostitute and she's an adult making her own decisions. I may not approve of it, but whatever. But when it's children are involved, it's pretty clear to most of us, at least, that it's not by choice.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about children, it gets really black and white. When you start talking about these are children being abused and facing horrible conditions in the sex trade, and it's all a form of statutory rape in the first place, there is widespread agreement that's something we should all rally around. There are some people who feel much more comfortable focusing specifically on the child sex trafficking aspect of human trafficking because they know that that's an area where there's so much agreement and there could be so much political will that it's almost a logical starting place for some people. To some degree, I agree with that approach, but I want to make sure that people understand that the totality of the issue includes adults and includes all these forms of labor trafficking too, And so if we're going to focus specifically on child sex trafficking, we should do that to raise people's awareness and to spotlight one part of the problem, but not to the detriment of somehow making it seem like that's the only form of trafficking, because there's huge problems with human trafficking, with labor trafficking in America, too, that when we sit on the national hotline that Polaris operates, we hear about every single day. So it's not just a child issue, although that is one of the most horrific parts of it.
When they're in that situation for a while, though, I have heard and I have read and talked to other experts who say that it's really, sometimes they don't perceive themselves as victims. And I wonder, when you're in an organization that is trying so hard to eliminate human trafficking and sex trafficking and whatnot, how much more difficult and more challenging does it make it when the person who we would perceive as a victim may not see him or herself that way?
Especially when you're talking about adults in a situation of human trafficking, was there evidence that they were held there by force, by fraud, by coercion? Was there violence? Was there threats? Was there lies? Was there manipulation? And many cases, traffickers engage in forms of brainwashing to try to manipulate the thoughts of the people that they're controlling. Many times traffickers try to create this total climate of fear and total climate of control. And so sometimes you have situations where the traffickers have just directly coached the victims to not see themselves as a victim. And the traffickers will say, you're the one to blame for this. You're the one, no one's controlling you, and they play these mind games with them. And so I think that when you encounter a victim of human trafficking, it's important to really see the world from their lens and to understand the environment that they've been in that the trafficker created for them. And sometimes it's a mental leap for average community members to try to understand that world. And therefore, you get some of these people asking questions like, well, why didn't this person just leave? Or I don't really believe that they were controlled. And I think when you get those types of questions, it's just revealing the fact that the person who's asking that probably isn't understanding the depths of control and manipulation and violence that this person just faced. But when we're working on the issue, we really see very, very clear forms of human trafficking and can identify that as such, even though sometimes the victim might not fully see it or phrase it that way and come out to you and say, I am a victim of human trafficking. Sometimes people don't quite say it that way, but they do say, yeah, I'm getting beat up a lot, and yeah, you know, my parents have been threatened. And so it's important to listen for the indicators instead of to listen to the person's description of how they would label what they just went through.
Is this something that one would pigeonhole as an issue of folks in certain neighborhoods, or does this happen all across the socioeconomic spectrum?
This happens all across the United States. We get calls on the national hotline from all 50 states. It's spread across cases in rural areas, suburban areas, urban areas. It spans the socioeconomic spectrum. And I think it's important really to understand that it really has metastasized all across the country.
Bradley Miles is the Chief Executive Officer of the Polaris Project. Brad, thanks for the time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The National Football League is counting on the Super Bowl to bring in tens of millions of dollars, if not more, into its coffers, and it won't be disappointed. The NFL also paid its commissioner, Roger Goodell, $44 million last year. Even taking all of that into account, the NFL is somehow a nonprofit. With me to explain that is Mary Feeney, Associate Professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU's College of Public Service and Community Solutions. She's also co-author of the book Nonprofit Organizations and Civil Society in the United States. Mary, how is it possible with all this money flying around that the NFL is a nonprofit?
Yeah, it's something that often surprises people. In the United States, the IRS classifies nonprofits in lots of different groups. So normally when we think about nonprofits, we're thinking of what are called 501c3s, which are public charities such as I mean, name your local church or a homeless shelter and the kind of, I think, nonprofits that come to mind for most Americans. There is a separate set of nonprofits known as 501c6s, and that's where the NFL falls under. These are business leagues, chambers of commerce, boards of trade, and estate boards. They serve as associations and organizations to advance a collective business interest. So, for example, the American Medical Association is a 501c6, as is the NFL.
Even with that explanation, it still strikes me as odd when you consider how much money they bring in. Also, the fact there is collective bargaining that goes on. So how does that all work in sync together?
In 1966, the IRS tax code was changed, and the classification of the 501c6s added football leagues. It was done in order to prevent the merging of the American Football League and another league at that time from falling under an antitrust violation. And so this was, the tax code was changed to accommodate the National Football Association League. It wouldn't surprise people, I think, in the sense that the NBA and Major League Baseball, they're for-profit organizations, while the NFL falls under this Football Association nonprofit group. The NHL and the PGA are also nonprofit associations. I think the thing that is really interesting here is the NFL has filed for this tax exemption as an association that's representing the interests of football leagues, but it doesn't include arena football, the multitude of amateur and semi-pro football leagues that we have in this country. And so it only includes the 32 NFL teams that are members. So unlike the American Medical Association, which represents a multitude of doctors, the NFL as an association is only representing this minor group of teams.
Is there any reason to think that at some point in the future, are there any elements that might make them want to reconsider that and go to Congress again and say, we don't really want to be a nonprofit?
I think if the NFL Association didn't want to be a nonprofit, they could not register to be a nonprofit at any point. From their perspective, it's, you know, they can or cannot apply for nonprofit status. It's up to them. But it is true that the Congress could take away their nonprofit status. There has been some movement. Tom Coburn, from the senator from Oklahoma, has sort of led the charge to remove this tax exemption status. There's been a few petitions that have emerged with around 200,000 signatures. So it's not something that the general public or the U.S. Congress is really mobilized to change. And I think this is partially because the NFL is quite popular in the United States and people enjoy the services provided by the National Football League. And I think most people don't recognize it as a nonprofit organization. We're not talking about huge amounts of money that the federal government's missing out on from the tax exemption. It's estimated that if the IRS were to remove the NFL tax exemption, it would result in about $109 million in revenue over 10 years. So in the larger scheme of things, that's not a huge amount of money for the federal government, but it's a large amount of money that would be revenue generated if they were paying taxes.
And I presume NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who cleared more than $40 million last year, is probably the highest paid head of a nonprofit.
Yes, he is not only being the highest paid, if you were to combine the CEO salaries of the top 25 paid CEOs of nonprofits in the United States, it would still be less than what he's making. So he's not just making a lot of money, he's making significantly more than other nonprofit CEOs. There is some argument, of course, that CEOs of nonprofits should be able to make a lot of money. I think if you want to compete to attract top executives and you're competing with private sector organizations, many nonprofits need to put a lot of money on the table to get top leadership. And I would think many Americans understand the need to sort of pay your talent. Whether he's worth $44 million is sort of something that I think the NFL Association has to consider. But if you combine the salaries of the top eight executives in the NFL Association, you're talking about a large chunk of change.
Recently, the Arizona Republic had a listing of the top nonprofit CEOs, whatever the title is, president in some cases, and what they were making. And there were letters to the editor where people were kind of offended, saying, boy, this person's making $350,000. That doesn't seem right to me based on what the mission of the organization should be. Any thoughts on that based on your research?
Yeah, I think, you know, there is some argument that these, you know, if you're running a nonprofit that's aiming at some sort of social good or public good, you should be sort of working for a lower wage. But I think the counter argument to that is if you want your nonprofit to be successful in pursuing some public good or providing a public service, you need real talent. And there are nonprofits in this country that are very large that require a really sort of complex set of skills and leadership and connections. And if your CEO is raising funds for your Metropolitan Art Museum or your ballet or your symphony, you're talking about a CEO or an executive director that needs sort of a high level of networks and talent. And many of these people have much higher paying options in the private sector. And so if nonprofits really want to compete for talent, they have to offer higher salaries. Some of the highest paid CEOs of nonprofits are running research institutions. Some are at universities. Some are at nonprofit hospitals. These are not sort of simple organizations to run. It's not a food bank. Mm-hmm. And so you do need a person with a certain set of skills that do require quite high pay, I think.
There are a lot of people who complain about the size of government, saying it's too big, whether at the federal level or state level or whatnot. And there have been, though, a lot of cutbacks. Certainly after the Great Recession, you've seen cutbacks state level, certainly city level, getting rid of a lot of programs that perhaps supported the community, some social programs. How has that affected, whether directly or indirectly, how many nonprofits we've seen sort of grow in the last decade mm-hmm. or so?
So in the United States, we've seen a real exponential growth in the nonprofit sector for a variety of reasons. A lot of that is because of downsizing in government. On the one hand, you'll see that when the government is no longer providing certain services, nonprofit organizations will step in and provide those services, in particular social services. But in a sort of other example of the growth of the nonprofit sector, you'll see that many of the restrictions on government spending have been restrictions on personnel and hiring. So legislation may be passed to fund a program, but it limits the amount of government employees that can be paid on that program. And government employees comes with pensions and benefits and can be quite expensive long-term in a government budget. So what some local governments, state governments, and the federal government will do is they will contract out those services through a nonprofit. So the government's paying for the service to be provided, but they're not sort of taking on the commitment of the salaries and the pensions and the sort of extra costs that come with personnel hires. So you'll also see a lot of nonprofits getting in the business of delivering government services.
Mary Feeney, associate professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU's College of Public Service and Community Solutions. She's also co-author of the book Nonprofit Organizations and Civil Society in the United States. She'll be speaking Saturday at 5:45 in the afternoon at ASU's downtown Phoenix campus. And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program, want to go back and hear one of our previous editions, you can go online this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ mobile app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you enjoy the rest of your afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.